Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
You don't want this case. I know you. What's that thing you say? Shit bowl? This is a shit bowl.
That's my shit bowl.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss HBO's True Detective Night Country, Season 4, Part 2.
Why are they naked?
Doesn't make any sense.
And later, Christopher Eccleston, who plays Captain Connolly, will be stopping by to talk about the case.
But let's do a quick recap first. Liz Danvers fights to keep the case in Ennis. She brings the slab of frozen researchers to the local ice rink to thaw out while she awaits forensics.
5 heads and 9 feet.
The rest of them are buried.
Danvers learns that researcher Raymond Clark was in a relationship with the murdered cold case victim, Annie Kay. And despite trying to fight it, Danvers and Navarro team up.
What are you doing here?
Well, you know Annie better than I can get from the files.
And now it matters because it's a bunch of white men?
You want in or you just want to go fuck yourself?
The investigation leads them to a creepy trailer owned by Raymond Clark with pictures of Annie plastered on the walls.
Yeah, that's her phone. I checked. It was not with her body.
And as the bodies thaw, they discover Raymond Clark isn't there.
He's alive. He's out there.
All right, I have to ask. When the head moved and started screaming, did you guys scream?
100%.
It was the most grotesque, and the noise.
And the sludge in the, coming
yeah,
out?
Yeah. And if you know what it felt like? It felt like in Seven when the sloth guy wakes up in the bed all of a sudden because you assume he's dead. I don't know medically how someone could survive being out in the cold like that for however
I guess if you're like in the middle, like closer to the center. Yeah.
You have your human blanket.
Don't they freeze people? Isn't Walt Disney frozen in a cryogenic chamber somewhere?
Right, exactly. That's true. I mean, if we had any doubt that this was leaning on horror tropes this season, they were gone after this moment because it was terrifying.
And it's also just like, this is a show we're not talking about the ending yet of the episode, I guess, but like this is a show that knows how to end on a cliffhanger that is going to make you like it works as a week to week watch, but it's going to be really good as a binge.
Yeah, I have like scary
Do
feelings.
Do you want to not talk about the corpses?
Yeah,
I can direct us in another direction.
Sure.
Which is, did you guys catch who Fiona Shaw's partner Travis is?
No, I did not.
His last name is Coley. He's Rust Cole's father.
What?
That's the Easter egg.
Oh my God.
So she talks about Travis. I was like, oh, this is weird. And I think at some point she does say, like, that's the only thing that Travis Cole left me.
Yeah,
and
she
was,
does. Yeah.
And
she
so I was Travis like, Cole. Could that be? And so I looked it up. According to the first season of True Detective, Travis, in fact, is the name of Rust's father.
Oh,
and he
wow.
moved to Alaska after, like, getting all messed up in Vietnam and raised Rust out there.
So we're all connected.
So we're in the same universe.
That's wild.
Which is fun.
That's cool. That is the kind of Easter eggy thing I do like.
Yeah. Yes.
Because you don't have to explain it much beyond that. It's just like...
No, it doesn't really have any bearing on anything. It's
right.
just like a fun, like, nod. And it's like the epigram that opened the first episode, yeah. which is like, you look at it and it's some nonsense and the, like, author of it is somebody you've never heard of, but you Google that name and it's the author of, like, The Yellow King.
Okay. So it comes back.
Which is, like, another True Detective. So, like, if you're looking for, like, little nods to the first season especially and, like, the earlier seasons of the show, like, you will find them. And I like that.
I like that. It's so great that it's connected to both the first season of True Detective and True Blood because Fiona Shaw is playing a witchy, scary woman. The whole first episode, I was like, that woman looks so familiar. Why do I know her? And I was like, oh, she was literally a witch on True Blood. Fiona Shaw stays working for HBO in shows that begin with True.
It's not Fleabag? That's your main
That's
connection.
My main Fiona Shaw. It's definitely True Blood.
You didn't see her in Beckett's Happy Days at BAM several years ago?
God damn, I wish.
Buried up to her neck in sand. She was quite good.
Rose Agano gets around.
Yeah. You know, there was a part of me when we have the scene with Navarro and Rose at her house.
You've seen the dead. When did that start?
Miss Travis. But I know people who are born with it. And then, of course, there's Ennis. It happens around here all the time.
Rose seems to sort of not fit in with the rest of the community. She's a little bit, she seems to maybe a little wealthier. She seems more educated, perhaps. Like, I was kind of like, well, I don't know. This feels like sort of a TV device. Like, would this person really live there? But then I was like, you know, I've been to Alaska 2 times.
Yeah,
and talking to locals, there are a lot of weird people who end up in Alaska. There's some statistic. I think only 1/5 of the population of Alaska was born there.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And so,
it like attracts people who are looking for something.
There's a great line in Insomnia, which I mentioned last week, where Maura Tierney, the great Maura Tierney, says, like, there are two kinds of people in Alaska, those who were born here and those kind of like fleeing something, basically. And I feel like with that kind of context, I buy Rose as this, like, Travis and I ended up here for vague reasons that I'm not really going to go into. But, like, I prefer to be out here in the cold, far away from most civilization.
Yeah, well, because that's where she can see dead people.
Right,
and
ghosts, right, right. Which apparently is a regular occurrence for her.
For her and everyone in Ennis.
She seems really chill about it.
Yeah, she does.
You would think she would be maybe more upset.
She's better at it than maybe some are. Yeah, this episode really, in I think really evocative ways, gets into a sort of collective consciousness of this town. Where there is, like, everyone sees things here. It's a really long night. Like, even the dead get, you know, bored or whatever. Like, this community, or as Rose says, is located on sort of this line where the earth is splitting apart. And, like, you know, which we had talked about last week, like, climate change, that's certainly part of it. Like, I don't know. I just found this episode so evocative in how it really drew us even further into the place.
Well, to that point, too, what you just said about Alaska, you know, most of the people are transplants. I mean, yeah. It goes back to sort of America's greatest sin, the original sin of, you know, native land, white people taking native land. Ennis has been here long, but these natives have been here longer.
Yeah.
And people, whatever's in the permafrost has been there even longer.
Longer, and it's going to be revealed over the course as it melts, as we melt down to, you know, the original sin. I think it's just, you know, these ghosts are coming. They're coming for all of these people.
Yeah. And a lot of these people probably deserve it.
Yeah, 100%.
That way.
Yeah. And you know who deserves it the most? Hank. And yeah. He might not have killed everyone in Salal, but he did slap his son, and I was so mad when that happened.
What do you make of his mail order bride? Endear him to you at all? Because, like, that's so sad.
It's so 90-day fiancé. It's so 90-day fiancé.
But it's going to go great, I think.
The way she was texting and him sending her money, definitely a good idea.
That's how that works. It's great.
I mean, she just probably needs it so that she can get on a plane and come meet him.
Yeah, and her mother, too.
In this tiny, horrid town in Alaska. She definitely wants to flee Russia to go there.
Yeah. With her mother in
town. You can see Russia from your house in Alaska. It's not so far.
It's true. I can't wait for his comeuppance. I don't know how it will happen, but I don't know. I didn't... I got weird vibes from him in the first episode, but this really cemented, oh, he's a bad guy.
And Leah says something about it where she's like, he's a monster or something, or like, so there's a history of this, clearly. I think my favorite part of this episode is that, because I was a diehard Lost fan, even though it broke my heart at the end. I love a creepy symbol, you know?
Well, we got it in the first episode when Jodi is standing in the middle of the spiral when she's putting all...
That's right,
she's standing dead center in the spiral. And I was like, that's a weird way to put all those photos of all the cases. And then we see it over and over and over again this episode.
So it's on one guy's forehead, right? We later learned that one of the scientists, Clark, got it tattooed. It's on the ceiling of this mysterious, pardon my French, fuck trailer.
As a fuck trailer.
And we should, not to be the season one police, but we should note that this spiral also has a history in the franchise. It's the symbol of, like, the pedophile cult.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Hello, you're really good at this.
Right.
you remember a lot.
I talked to Issa Lopez.
That is true.
I cannot stress that enough. Some of these connections, she did help.
Okay.
I feel like this season would argue that the pedophile cult co-opted a symbol that has different meaning for these people.
Which is a really fun twist on
it. Yeah, I like that. I like that. Because, you know, Rose says, like, it's this symbol is really old. It's older than, you know, older than the ice kind of thing.
And it speaks to the theme. If it then got, like, as you said, co-opted by these people that corrupted its meaning and then turned it into,
right.
Took over it, took over it. And it was on Annie, we have to say. It was on Annie K's shoulder.
Right. So this, because this episode really establishes that Annie K and this guy Clark, even though the researchers were mostly thought to be complete recluses who didn't talk to the house cleaners, you know, that at least one of them did venture out into the world enough to meet a young woman in town and begin a relationship.
And take her back to his fuck trailer.
His fuck trailer. That he bought from some asshole miner guy.
It was so, I don't know if anyone else has seen that. It was so Mother God. It was so Love Has Won, the cult. And then you see, like, the body, like, in the trailer, made out of twine or what. I was like, ooh.
That's so creepy.
So creepy.
That area was called The Nook, was it?
The Nook.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a little kind of funny. The device, like, where would you keep a secret here? The Nook!
And she didn't eat her pancakes. She just,
That her nice bath-taken boyfriend made for her.
Man, there's something happening there. Just let him love you.
I know.
Let him in.
So the sex that we get in this episode is not of the, like, Not the fun variety.
No. Another twist.
Danvers's sex life is a fun area.
Not to be this way, but she do be getting around, it seems.
It's funny. Yeah, it's a small town. I guess that there's a limited number of men in their 50s.
Yeah.
Or younger.
I think it's funny that it's a little comeuppance to the head, the mean head of the mine that she slept with her husband.
So funny.
Who teaches science at the high school?
No, he's the science teacher, the geology.
The line, if you wanted English, you should have fucked the English teacher.
A+. Right.
That was great.
And the teacher, he expands another mystery that of many we have on this show, where we didn't really know in the first episode what these scientists were doing. And he's now saying, this teacher is basically saying, oh, if their crackpot research experiments actually panned out, they could, like, cure most diseases. Yeah. So this is, like, very significant and almost kind of drills to the core of, like, what mortality is.
To the core. I'm glad you said that. Did you notice that he was teaching about the Earth's core and it was, like, a bunch of circles? It looked like a spiral, the lesson that he was teaching. And it was, like, going the mantle.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. I'm like, there was a hint there. There's a clue.
So, knowing that the scientists are kind of, you know, it seems like they're playing God in a way. And that also feels like we're kind of moving toward a Frankenstein kind of subplot there, which is, you know, and Frankenstein ends on the ice, so it doesn't seem coincidental. But are they flying? Are they reaching too far? Like, are they doing something that science should not do? Are they disturbing the natural order?
And who are they using to do that? Who are they? They could be using
In the name of curing cancer. Like, what are they do their ends justify their means?
Not to go full, you know, Tuskegee science experiment, but it could be something like that, where there these white men are playing with the brown people's lives and using them to do their crazy, fucked up, horrific experiments.
Yeah,
that could be definitely, I could see that being part of the narrative or where this goes.
Oh, for sure, because it's been made clear that unlike other research stations, which swap people out and that, you know, people come and go, these guys were really holed up there.
They're at Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Yeah, right, exactly.
No one goes in, no one comes out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's been clear to me since the first episode that these scientists were up to something bad, mm-hmm. because I don't think they were like the... I mean,
you were like, that sandwich doesn't look good.
That sandwich didn't look good. No, it just, there's just, I mean, I think it's like the idea of the season, this fourth season of True Detective being about a woman's perspective, you know, in the first scene of the first episode, this guy saying she's awake and then they all end up dead. It's like, they did something bad to a woman.
Yeah.
Well, right? Knowing that, and I guess we're not in predictions land yet, but like knowing that Clark was involved with Annie Kay and knowing that the person who murders the woman is usually the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
And knowing that Clark is alive, the twist at the end, what we think. Which is wild. It's like when they were like.
It's hard to count the bodies when they're all frozen together, let's say.
I feel like a silly little idiot because I was completely not ready for that twist. I was like, okay, of course all the people at Salal were all frozen together. But of course there's one missing.
Also didn't see it coming.
Did not see it coming.
A good twist.
A good, honest to God twist.
And yeah, clearly he knows something. Well, he's not letting on because we don't even know where he is.
We don't know where he is, but he's somewhere.
He's the key.
He is the key. He's definitely somewhere out there, and he's not in his fuck hut or fuck trailer.
What do we think about the introduction of this kind of foil for Danvers in Captain Connolly, the Christopher Eccleston character? They're obviously involved in a sort of ongoing thing, but also antagonistic professionally. Like, does that feel like a device or like, does he fit into this ecosystem for you guys?
I like knowing how she got there because Ennis, Alaska is so random. So it does make sense that it was like, well, you were in Anchorage and I sent you away because we don't know exactly what she did.
Probably from fucking something.
Probably from fucking somebody. Yeah, because that seems to be something she gets up to.
She drives her trailer all around Alaska.
That's her MO. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, but I liked it because again, as we said last week, the small town feel, everybody being connected, it would feel very random to just have, like, the Anchorage, you know, I'm the guy from Anchorage, and I'm here to tell you, I need my case.
Well, and in the way that the show is either playing with or just kind of embodying, like, classic tropes, like, this is also, like, the police, like, story. Like, oh, like, something is happening in the small town, and, like, here come the feds in to, like, take the case away from us, so we've got to, like, put our minds together, because only we know this town, and we're the only ones who can actually find it out, because they're going to screw up if you know the big leagues gets involved.
And then it adds, can she do it? Can she solve it?
But I think what's interesting about that tension of can she do it, can she solve it, and why isn't she just like shipping it down, the case down to Anchorage, is that like Danvers has said repeatedly about Annie Kay and about the researcher's case, we're like, this is never gonna get solved. Mm-hmm. Ennis killed Annie Kay. We were never gonna find anybody. And she seems to kind of feel this thing about the research guys, and yet something is keeping her invested in it. So I guess, I don't know, my interpretation is that her sort of pessimism is kind of an act because she doesn't want to disappoint herself or anyone else.
Mm-hmm. She really cares too much.
Right, right.
Like
right.
All good cops.
What do we make of Danvers's resistance to Leah exploring or expressing her native identity? That's a really interesting character bit for Danvers because it really makes you not like her.
Yeah, well, it goes, I think, a little bit to what I was saying last week, that she has this complicated, kind of messed up relationship with race and indigenous people, even though she's so embedded in it. And we didn't even mention that Peter has a native wife or girlfriend and native, you know, half native son.
Whose name is Darwin, which also feels pointed in
feels
some
pointed.
Way.
I'll say it. I kind of appreciate that the show isn't making her some white savior who completely is cool with all races and creeds and whatnot. Because
or even like the white person who like is better at being a native than the native people are, which is also such a trope in this sort of story where it's like, you know, only like once Daniel Day-Lewis like learns how, like he is the last of the Mohicans because he's the one who actually understands things even better.
It.
Like he can be a better Indian than the Indians.
Yeah. This feels way more true to, I think, a lot of white people's relationship with race in terms of, it might not be explicitly quote unquote racism of the capital R, but there are clearly assumptions and negative feelings there. That I love Peter's wife being like, get out of my house, get out, you witch.
Yeah. Seems like she's got to put up with a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had questions about Peter's wife because an overused trope in usually cop stories is like, the spouse that doesn't get how much time it's going to take, you know, like, oh, come
and
on.
And there's always like, where are you? Like, yeah. Your family needs you too.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And or like you, the kid is performing on stage and sees the empty chair where dad's supposed to be sitting or where mom's supposed to be sitting. And I thought that like her being like, no, work ends at 6. And it's like, there are a lot of bodies thawing in the ice rink right now. So that might require a little overtime.
They do demand some attention.
Yeah, you know, but no, I think that I like the added dynamic of him having married a Native woman, like, because Peter's from there. You know, he's not like, he's not one of these minor transplants or whatever. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that the way the show is looking at race is intriguingly complex.
Yeah, and we've also got Navarro, who is a product of two different worlds as well, and who has clearly some generational trauma happening. We get that flashback. You know, her mother was mentally ill, it seems, and her sister, it seems like, has inherited some of that stuff. She is maybe not the most stable person herself right now, but she's also kind of tapped more into, you know, the spiritual side of things than Danvers is. And that seems, I don't know, like intuition is helping her, I think, and like making it easier for her to solve this case.
Right, right. The cross that she finds in the car, how did that get there? Like, how supernatural is that supposed to be?
Well, that's the question.
And throwing that out on the side of the road, that's never a good idea. Yeah.
Well, that's gonna come back.
It's gonna come back.
That's bad juju, yeah.
Pretty worried, yeah.
I do think Navarro, and something that we should keep an eye on, is the miners versus that big fight that happened in the bar between like that white guy who was like, I don't know Clark, but was like, I sold him his fuck trailer.
Right.
And the native people who are like, they're suffering. Their water is sludge. Their water is black because of what's happening at the mine. And it's affecting because who lives on the outer communities? Often the most marginalized people in a community, and they're the ones who are being affected by, you know, the miners and what seems to be, this might be the climate storyline that we sort of found last episode, where there's really terrible things are happening because of the ills of the white people in this town. But yet, on the other hand, the miners are, that's the only thing they have to do there. What else are you doing, Ennis?
And they built the school, and they built the ice rink, and they're funding this perhaps life-saving research, you know, like it's a really, really uneasy kind of symbiotic relationship that needn't have existed if white people had never showed up.
Yes.
that's the thing. But now that they're there, I guess the mine can control the town by, you know, kind of like the mafia does, like, we'll protect you, we'll give you things, but you have to be loyal to us and you cannot push back against us because...
Yeah, like nice society you have here. Shame if something were to happen to
you. Yeah. Right, exactly. And, you know, and I think that it's fun to be in the early stages of watching this season, in that, like, I don't know which direction the show is going to pivot. Is it about the evils of the mining company? Is it about some different evil? Is it about the evils of the research station? Is it about all of it? I don't know.
Yeah. And it's so crazy because there's not, I mean, we're 40% of the way there, right? It's like we only have four episodes left. It's a short season. So there's a lot.
Which is nice because it does feel like, it feels like the show is not wasting time with red herrings, really.
No. Everything feels purposeful. And even if certain things end up just being evocative, like the spiral thing, like whatever, that's fine. I like the mood it's setting, but it also feels like we are efficiently moving through toward revelations and, you know, new information and all that.
I do feel like we're going to probably have to wait until the very end to figure out what happened to Jody's maybe native son. What, like, that flashback, like, we know that she had.
And how long ago was that? Do we know? No.
Not clear. And there was an allusion last episode with the drunk driving, and like, maybe I sort of was like, well, did Jody, like, kill her husband and son?
So Leah's 16?
Yeah, 17. And so her Leah's, girlfriend's 16.
Right. So Leah's 17. Jody Foster is 61. Mm. Did she have this, like, young child who died when she was, like, 45?
Yeah. The timeline.
When she was, like, 50? I'm not totally sure. I'm not going to harp on it too much. I don't really care. It's just kind of fun to be pedantic.
It's fun to be pedantic. And the timeline is, it's a tricky. It's not, the math isn't exactly mathing. But I am curious because clearly, I mean, we have the recurring image of this polar bear toy that keeps haunting Jody, and we get a little bit in the flashback, but there's more to that story, and I wonder if it will play into the actual narrative of this.
If she was responsible for an accident that killed her husband and her son, like, that does, you know, explain some of the misanthropy that we're getting from her.
Yeah.
It's maybe a pat explanation, like I was saying before, you know, in turn, this is like a trope that I think you see a lot. And I think that the show is smart in a lot of ways, and I feel like it could have maybe come up with a more creative explanation for, like, Danvers' whole deal.
That said, I want to know her whole deal. Yeah, it also would make sense, and I'm curious to know her whole deal, too.
Yeah, I do too. I think I also want to know, well, obviously, I think we're going to learn more about this Clark guy, his whole deal. But we learned a little bit about, like, he was seen naked outside the station once, right?
Yeah, well, his butt, everything yeah. hanging out, they
right,
said.
Right, right. And that delivery driver says that when he went there and found the place empty, he thought he saw someone. Mm-hmm. And then Danvers or Navarro was like, who was it? Like, what'd you see? He's like, no, everyone sees things here. Mm-hmm. Everyone sees people here.
So, yeah, if Clark is still skulking around at the station.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly. Like, is he still there? Is he like Newt in Aliens, the last one roaming around? Or the driver saw whatever monster is out there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, yeah. that would be a very horror thing, too, if there's like a gradual pan up to the ceiling and there's Clark. Like
right, right.
Grabbed onto right. it.
Well, exactly. I hope he's fixing a light up there because they keep flickering in that station.
Because whatever happened to these people, they tore their eyes out.
Their eardrums are ruptured.
Their eardrums are ruptured. They were so scared that they ran out into the Arctic tundra without shoes on. And when Danvers and Peter are kind of doing Danvers's like routine of like, okay, that's not the right question. What's the right question?
Start asking questions.
Okay. Polar bear. The doors don't lock, right? To avoid accidents.
Okay.
It comes in. The men panic. They run out.
And they undress. Why?
Paradoxical undressing. People with severe hypothermia, they feel hot, they undress.
You've been studying. All right, keep asking.
Ugh. They arrive at, what would you be so scared of that you would run out like that? And so, like...
And the answer is a strong woman in her 60s taking control of her own sexuality.
Right, exactly. I don't know. I had sort of predicted last week that it was a group of people who were responsible for this. And I don't know. I'm increasingly like, could one person have inspired or, you know, these researchers to basically run out into the cold and die? You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
it would have to be a pretty formidable person in some respect.
Maybe they have trained polar bears at their disposal. We don't know.
There you go. That could be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Where did all those caribou go? Where did all those from the first scene?
Yeah, I don't know if that's just scene setting or if it actually matters.
I know. Yeah, I'm like, what in that man who was going to shoot them? I mean, where's like, we don't know anything about him.
Well, yeah, and like. Rose has basically said this place is sick. It is at the nexus of a dying world, and it's being torn apart. Like, I don't think there's any nature is healing vibes about this, and I think the caribou were just maybe saw what was coming, and we're out.
Yeah,
bye. It's been good. But yeah, I like the sort of elemental mystery, the earth kind of like groaning under the weight of all these bad people.
And like rebelling against the people that are exploiting it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, these researchers who were trying to extract something life-saving and in some ways good, except like you said, Hillary, maybe they took it too far.
Too far, but, yeah. Which people often do.
Yes, what if science, but too much?
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Christopher Eccleston.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't
miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
We've said this a couple of times, but Liz Danvers butted more than just heads with Captain Connelly, if you know what I mean.
And speaking of butts, we saw a lot of Christopher Eccleston.
Christopher Eccleston, who's done great work on HBO in the past and in the Leftovers and everything like that. So it was really exciting that we got to talk to him about True Detective Night Country here in part two as the mystery unfolds. So listen to that conversation and enjoy.
I'd love to know, now we're sort of two episodes into True Detective Night Country, how have you been paying attention to the audience reaction or sort of the fan reaction to the first episode, like after it came out? What was your response?
Yeah, I was at the premiere in Los Angeles, so I saw a reaction, I saw an audience reaction, and also I saw episode one myself. And I'm not somebody who watches a lot of drama, and I'm certainly not somebody who watches myself. Fortunately, I wasn't in that episode. and I'm aware of the reviews, and the reaction to it has been extraordinary. And there's a 5-star review in my own newspaper today, The Guardian. So yeah, it's been overwhelmingly positive.
I'd love to go way back to the beginning. Were you a True Detective fan going into Night Country when you were cast in the
project? I wasn't. I have to confess, I'm not somebody who watches a lot of drama because I spend my life making it. I'm hypercritical and I like to switch off from work. So I'm more of a documentary and news, sport and music person. I'm aware of it. I'm aware of how highly regarded it is. I'm aware that there was a critical fall away. I think that's fair to say. I don't think the audience reaction and the critical reaction was as strong after series one. And it sounds to me like what was needed was a reconfiguration of it. And with Issa and Jodie, that's what it, I think it's rejuvenated the franchise from what I can tell. That's what I felt on the set. It's what attracted me to the project was that feminine power. And approach.
No, totally. And you can you can feel it and see it, particularly with Jodie Foster. And your character's, Connelly's relationship with Liz Danvers, we see is quite a complicated, interesting relationship. Can you talk a little bit about how much you knew going into filming that you would have this sort of romantic yet also adversarial yet also, you know, boss employee relationship with Jodie Foster's Liz Danvers?
I think it's something that happens a great deal in the workplace, isn't it? The relationship has gone on for the relationship, if that's what we can call it, has gone on for a good few years, so there's obviously some deep feelings there. It's implied that, you know, Danvers tells herself she's there purely for the sex, and only Jodie would know the answer to that. But I suspect that he's in love with her.
Really?
I think he's in love with her, and I think he covers it.
Well, that's quite interesting because...
And I think the final act is, to a certain extent, an act of emotional revenge, but that really is spoilers. And we've got to be careful about that, I think.
We can be careful, but I like where your head's at, and we can definitely, you know, hint at what's to come. I will say that's an interesting, I think that's such an interesting take, just because Danvers sort of implies that she's only in NS Alaska because Connelly sent her away.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very patriarchal, controlling thing that he enacts. And she, for all her power, allows to... happen, or does she allow it to happen, or is she powerless because it's such a strong patriarchal structure?
Can you tell me a little bit about filming and working with Jodie Foster? And I mean, and you have to have like this love scene, you know, your butt's out there. There's a lot, you're bearing a lot of yourself.
Yeah. Well, fortunately for me, Jodie and myself are exactly the same generation. So we came through doing sex scenes before Me Too, before the advent of intimacy coaches. So we'd gone the same route, albeit in different genders. So we were very versed in how to behave towards another actor. And so it was just, it was very funny, really, because the first day I met Jodie and Issa in person, because I was cast and then I flew over there, and we were discussing the sex scene, we were just discussing the relationship, and I leant on a rehearsal table and it smashed in two and I fell on my back. which made Issa and Jody hysterical with laughter. And then me and Jody laid out debris at this smashed table, and my humiliation had a photograph. And to be honest, that did the job for us. That gave us the shorthand because we realized we had exactly the same sense of humor and same approach. You know, take the work seriously, but don't take yourself seriously at all, which really helps in a sex scene.
Mm.
And then we did have a great intimacy coach, you know, because that's a great positive thing in the industry. And we had a very strong, I think sometimes the issue with sex scenes is the writer doesn't or can't or won't write exactly what, because if you have a sex scene between two characters, it's there not for titillation, as far as I'm concerned. It's there to tell a story about the relationship. And because Issa had written that, and there's a scene in episode one, a sex scene with Navarro, which there's a unity and there's an echo between those two scenes. And it tells a tale about, predominantly it tells a tale about female sexuality. So what was freeing about that was there was no titillation. It was narrative. We're telling a story about a physical, an emotional relationship physically. Mm. And it was a lot of fun.
I feel, you know, you're spot on in terms of these sort of scenes telling a story and giving us more insight.
Yeah. The only reason it should be there is to enlighten you about the characters, not to titillate. But I was very fortunate because I was doing a sex scene with a woman, and it was being shot and directed by a woman. You know, there's a great deal of vulnerability involved in something like that. I have hang-ups about my appearance physically, just like anybody else. But I've always found, generally, working with a female in charge, the vulnerable element to your work is easier to do. But also the changes in the industry have really helped.
I do want to sort of unpack further. You talk about the sort of like patriarchal struggle, and this season is so sort of led by women, run by women, and your cop, it's sort of unclear by episode two how much we should trust Connolly, whether or not he really has Danvers' best interest in heart. I mean, without giving too much away, how do you suspect the audience should feel about him at this juncture?
I think she should probably see him through Danvers' eyes. I think the guide should be Jodie's brilliant performance, actually. I think, how would it feel to be in a relationship with that man? How is she observing him? What is she saying to him? And I would try not to guide an audience whether to trust or not trust a character, because when you play a character, you try not to judge them. Mm. You try to just play them. We all self-justify, don't we? Everything we do, we justify it to ourselves. So I want to leave that to the audience. It'll be interesting to see their response.
Mm. You've been in a bunch of shows and projects, and some of them which are quite supernatural and kind of terrifying in nature. I think The Leftovers is a great example. I would say 28 Days Later. But this has a whole new flavor. I mean, we've got this corpsicle of all these naked men screaming and clawing their eyes out.
It makes a change from naked women, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I was just about to ask, can you talk a little bit about the horror elements and even the supernatural elements in this show, and as compared to other things that you've been involved in the past?
Well, I've worked in quite a lot of genre stuff. I'm not as, you know, I've not seen the finished piece yet. I've only seen episode one, so I've not seen the whole show. But I found it, and as somebody who doesn't watch a lot of television drama, really thrilling. And that there was so many, we let a lot of hairs go in that first episode. And I love that stuff when it's done well. When it's woven into a story rather than just for shock value. And the opening sequence with the bison, it's just fantastic. And the polar bear, all that stuff. I mean, and I think what always anchors special effects and horror is the stuff around it. So you've got Jodie Foster anchoring all of that with her very truthful performance. The intelligence and truth of a performance makes you by the more genre-like elements of it. Mm. All of the performances. You need realism to sit alongside that kind of thing, which you had with Cillian Murphy in 28 Days Later, for instance. Mm. The truth of his performance in that made you believe in all the zombie elements.
That is actually, that's a great corollary. Yeah, the groundedness, yeah. Right, of the relationships, yeah. And the actors, yeah. It lets you explore these other supernatural elements. Yeah. I gotta ask, are you rooting for your boy Cillian on the awards circuit, yes. For Oppenheimer?
I am, yeah. Because I worked with him right at the beginning of his career. That was his big break, 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
And he was such a gentleman then. And I've bumped into him a number of times down the years, and he's not changed. Very modest, very unassuming, very decent man.
I guess to bring it back to Night Country, it leads me to sort of watch these episodes multiple times just to figure out if I'm missing anything, or because I'm trying to solve the mystery just like everybody else. And I don't, yeah. know, you said you haven't seen every episode, but I'm sure you've seen every script. Is without, again, giving anything too much away, is there anything that we should be paying close attention to? You know, I know that the opening credit sequence seems to have some clues.
You should pay attention to absolutely everything, because it all pays off. Mm. That's the beauty of it. There's no, it's all by the end, and it's going to be hard for people to believe, but by the end, it all ties together. So yeah. Pay attention to everything, because it's all there if you look closely.
Okay, because that's not always the case with, yeah. these detective shows where there, yeah. are red herrings, there are things that are thrown in there just to, mm-hmm. get you off path.
Not this time.
Thank you so much, Chris, for stopping by. This has been a really great and insightful interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a minute. When we return, we'll narrow down the suspects with our predictions.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
All right, it's that time in the episode when we have to make a prediction for whodunit. We have 1 week's worth of predictions banked.
Yeah.
By the end, whoever is closest or most consistent, or, you know, one of us could have predicted correctly on the first episode and then incorrectly predicted for the rest of the season, but they could still win.
They could still win. Yeah. Those are the rules of the game.
And they win an IC.
Because the rules, yeah. are arbitrary and we're, yeah. making them up right now.
Yeah.
Whose line is it anyways?
All right, Chris, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay, so I said Hank last week, and while I was certainly right about his character. He seems too stupid to have pulled off. Yeah.
If you can fall for the Russian mail-ordered bride trick,
you're probably not responsible for the deaths of, you know, 8 scientists. So I'm going to pivot, and this might be a little controversial, but I am like, okay, Annie's brother. Annie's brother. What's going on there?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because he has, obviously, a good reason. His sister was brutally murdered. She was involved with Clark, a scientist guy. That, mm-hmm. is enough of a reason, a motive to be like, seek revenge. And he's popped up a little bit. We keep revisiting him, and he seems like a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. But I would get why he would want to murder those scientists.
That's a good guess, I think, too, because that is sort of a classic mystery thing where, like, the answer is somebody who we've met, but, yeah. it's not necessarily a main character. It's something that, I mean, this is something that Issa Lopez said. Did I mention that I interviewed her? This is something that she said also is, like, you can solve the mystery by watching the show. Like, the show, the mystery, the answer is somebody who you've seen from the beginning, she said.
Okay.
So that is, it's not like, which somebody. I mean, that was my complaint about the first season of True Detective, which is like, you can't really solve the mystery by watching the show because the answer turns out to be like this, like, rando guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Which feels like cheating.
Yeah. But, yeah. now that we're in this cloistered community, yeah, it's somebody, it's Julianne Nichols' son.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
like, also, you know, it's possible to have come to that conclusion, but it's like a wild. So, yeah, maybe, mm-hmm. it's something like that. But yes, I like where you're headed.
That's where I'm placing my bets on.
Okay.
Yeah. And his brother.
If Clark is responsible for Annie K, which I feel like, you know, maybe that's so obvious that it won't be true, but if it is true, then I think you are on the money that the Salal scientists are dead as a result of a revenge.
Revenge plot killing.
Okay.
Revenge.
I think that I agree with that, except I have a twist on it. Now that we know that Clark at least did not die out in the snow, maybe he's dead elsewhere. I don't know. But that he had this relationship. We don't know yet if the relationship turns south. We can infer, but we don't know. I think that one of the other Salal guys killed Annie Kay out of jealousy or something. And then when we see Clark at the beginning, he's pretending. He's scaring them.
When he does his shaky thing?
Yeah. And so he's the one who chases
them.
Yeah, so he's alive somewhere because he was getting revenge for Annie's death.
Oh, wow. Okay, so now we think Clark is not a hero, but Clark is maybe not a...
An avenging angel or something.
Okay. Yeah. I like that, too, yeah.
Because, like, you know, they got the tattoos. They were really in love. Right. They had a fuck trailer. When two people love each other very much.
They get a horrifying nightmare cave.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, one in the nook, you know?
And matching, like, pedophile tattoos.
Great.
True love. Perfect.
Hillary, you got to lock in a prediction.
Okay, so if I'm going to stick with Clark being responsible for Annie because I just, you know, it's the boyfriend. Like,
it's often the boyfriend.
It's the butler, it's the boyfriend. But for the scientists, I mean, Fiona Shaw probably doesn't actually have anything to do with anything. But I still like the idea. Like, she's so cultured and refined. Like, what if, I don't know. Maybe she is still somehow the mastermind of, like, this, like, revenge scheme. Because I don't know. I want her to be there for some reason.
Maybe she's kind of like Holly Hunter in Top of the Lake, where she leads a group of people, and her group went out and did it.
I like that.
Yeah, almost a little culty, but not quite culty. Either that, or it's the drunk lady who screamed a lot.
Who blows
If the
Hank
show is really tight, then yes, that drunk lady will come back at some point. Yeah.
That does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christress.
And me at Hillabuster. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias. We had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. We were mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We will be back next Sunday for part 3 of True Detective Night Country. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.